this morning, I want to talk to you guys about busyness. Anybody busy? Yeah, I'm busy. We're all busy. Happens to us all the time. We talk about how busy we are, but we don't often do much to change it. We don't often do much about it. It's just sort of the way of our world, right? Well, the issue with busyness is that we absolutely need to understand that busyness has an effect on our lives, and busyness gives us stress, and there is something about it that is kind of destroying who we are as people. What's really fascinating, I was reading about this as I was preparing for this message, and we feel really, really busy. Most surveys say that people feel like they're super, super busy. But when we look at the amount of time that we spend, for example, with our kids today, as opposed to the amount of time a generation or two ago they spent with their kids, we're actually spending more time with our kids nowadays than we were before. But here's the problem, is that in our society and in our culture, we've blurred the lines of time. And so what happens is, when we're spending time with our kids, we're actually thinking we probably should be working and getting stuff done. But when we're working, we're thinking we probably should be spending time with our kids, right? So there's all this sort of blurring of lines, and we feel busy, and the effect is the same. Our schedules are packed, and we always feel like we should be doing something different, going in a different direction. So I want to talk a little bit about this. Let me see, what is my first slide? Yeah, so I think this is really fascinating. There was this psychiatrist and the director of the Anxiety Disorders Clinic at Johns Hopkins said this. He said, emotional distress due to overbusyness manifests as difficulty focusing. Sorry, I lost my place. And concentrating. Impatience and irritability. Quit laughing. Trouble getting adequate sleep and mental and physical fatigue. I don't know about you, but that looks sort of like a description of things that I experience on a regular basis, right? And he goes on to say, this is a vicious cycle, of course, because emotional distress leads to trouble with sleep and fatigue, and lack of sleep and exercise leads to more distress. So this is Johns Hopkins. This is one of the leading medical centers in the United States saying, look, stress is not a good thing. Stress caused by busyness has all of these negative side effects, all of these bad things. And so it's kind of like what I like to think of is the story of my car. I'm going to tell you the story of the first car that Elisa and I ever bought when we were married. We got married and we bought a brand new car. It was actually the only new car we've ever bought. Ever since then, we bought used cars. We bought a Saturn, okay? It was a 1996 Saturn SL2 with a spoiler and a sunroof. It was a great car. It was a manual stick shift. It was a lot of pep. We loved the car. We dragged it all across the country. We moved it to California. We moved it back to Texas. We moved it to North Carolina. We moved it to Oregon. And then we moved it here to Delaware. And I had been driving this car for a while. And gradually over time, one of the idiosyncrasies of this particular model of Saturn was that it would burn oil. Didn't really leak it, there weren't puddles anywhere, but it excessively burned oil, so it consumed oil in a way that most cars shouldn't. Normally when you change your oil shouldn't be low, it should just change out, right? But every time I changed my oil, it was like low and sometimes even empty, right? So the little oil light would always come on, and I would be like, oh my gosh, I've got to get an oil change, and then I'd do it. But over time, you know what happened? I kind of started to ignore the warning signs. I kind of started to ignore the light that was coming on. Yeah, I know I need to do that, but it was fine last time. I can go a little longer. I kind of started to ignore the clicking sound that was coming from the engine when I was driving it. And then one day I was on my way to Hershey, PA, and I was driving right, it's etched into my brain, at the exit for Elizabethtown off of whatever road that is, if you know where that is. And I was going down the exit ramp, and I downshifted from fifth gear into fourth gear to slow down the car. And the engine went ka-chunk, ka-chunk, and it shut off. And I coasted down the road. And I spent the whole day calling, got a tow to a local repair shop in Hershey because I couldn't take it all the way back here to Newark. And the mechanic looked at it finally the next day, I think, and he basically said, well, your engine melted. It overheated. There was no oil, and the engine just went. So the car was dead. I killed my car. Because I ignored the warning signs. It was trying to tell me, it was trying to say, we're low on oil here, we're getting overheated, things are bad. But I had learned over time to adjust my expectations because it was okay last time. I think we do that with stress, especially the stress that's induced by busyness. Our schedules are crazy and they're packed and we know we're stressed, but we somehow make it through. And so the next time when our body sends us that warning sign, things are not good, that's okay. We made it last time and we push through. We ignore the warning signs and it's bad for our health and pretty soon our engine is going to melt. Okay, so there are a few things I want to talk about here. Whatever's next. Nope, there's something next. Yes, so stress induced from busyness, I was reading about this, it's really fascinating, does a lot of things to our body. The first thing it does is it actually shrinks the brain's gray matter. Why is gray matter important? Well, gray matter is the place in your brain where certain things happen. I'll read you the list. Seeing and hearing, memory, emotions, speech, decision-making, and self-control. Gray matter is kind of important in the brain. It's the stuff where all the real stuff's happening, and the white matter is what connects the gray matter to the other gray matter, and it's just, it's important that we have it. But literally, medical studies indicate that when we are under stress, the gray matter shrinks. Our brains literally shrink from the stress. That's a big deal. The next thing that happens is that stress actually compromises our sleep. And this was a fascinating find for me, that this particular researcher says that when our sleep is compromised, it lowers our moral awareness. When we're sleep deprived, we don't have the moral awareness that we do when we're fully awake. And that, of course, moral awareness is a precursor to moral decision making. So literally, lack of sleep makes you less nice. It makes you less able to make good moral decisions. So that's a fascinating thing. And then the third thing I want to talk about is this thing called epigenetic markers. Now, I had a lot of fun researching this this week because I'm very fascinated by stuff like this, and I'm going to geek out for just a second. So we all know what DNA is. Our DNA is what basically gives us our traits and our behaviors, and there's a lot of argument about whether our behaviors are mostly influenced by nature or nurture. So nature would be our DNA, the things we inherit, and then nurture would be our environment, the things that influence us, right? But there's sort of this third thing that we're now discovering that has to do with DNA. We have a lot of DNA. In every single cell in our body, there's all of our DNA. And if you took that one strand of DNA and unwound it and stretched it out, it would be about 6 feet tall, right? That's in one cell. So that much DNA is crammed, packed into each tiny little cell. So how does that function? How does all that DNA fit? Well, I discovered DNA. No, I learned by reading about other smart people's discoveries, I learned that the DNA is actually wound around these cells, these other little cells that are like spools. So if you imagine like a spool of thread, you can put a long string of thread on a pretty small spool, and the DNA is wound up pretty tightly, right? So we have all these genes in our strand of DNA, but they're not all active all the time. So what tells the DNA which genes to activate and which ones to not activate? Well, it's this thing that they're discovering now called epigenetic markers. Epi, meaning like to lay on top of, epigenetics is these chemicals or these markers or proteins, I'm not sure exactly what they are, but they're markers that basically go on top of the DNA and they tell the DNA to uncoil at a particular place. And you can induce this and the genes will uncoil and whatever gene that is will activate. Or you can have the opposite. There can be epigenetic markers that tell those genes to kind of coil back up again and not be active. Now this is fascinating. Why is this fascinating? Because we always think about our genes and our genetics as something that's fixed and it's always the way it is. But that's not exactly true. It's not what they're finding. One of the things that was interesting is they looked at the famine that happened in Holland, right? So the Dutch famine of 1944 when the Germans blockaded Holland and they didn't have any food. And the average caloric intake for a person went from 2,000 calories a day to 500 calories a day. They didn't have a lot of food. And so women who were pregnant during that time, obviously, gave birth to children who had a very, very low birth weight. That's to be expected. But what was not expected was, they couldn't figure out, until now we're kind of figuring out why, that the next generation of babies born, after there was plenty of food, still had a low birth weight. Because something had happened genetically The epigenetic code had been changed for those mothers, so they passed this epigenetic marker on to their children, and so the body's DNA literally was changed in a way that made them give birth to low birth weight babies. This has been replicated in labs with other lab animals. You can induce all kinds of things. And now there's even cancer treatments that are focusing on this, because we all have genes that are cancer-suppressing genes that our epigenetics can either say to turn on that cancer-suppressing, to tumor-killing gene, or turn off that tumor-killing gene. It's fascinating. It's fascinating stuff. What does this have to do with Jesus? Well, I'll get there. Jesus made it all. That's it. That's the deal. Jesus made it. But here's the deal. Stress, when you undergo stress, it literally changes your epigenetic code. It changes the programming of your body, of how you learn to respond to stress, of how your body reacts to stress. It's not necessarily changing your genes and giving you different genes, different DNA, but those epigenetic markers tell your DNA what to do and what not to do, what genes to turn on and what genes to turn off. And I think that's important to know. And what we know is that when we flood the body with cortisol, which is the stress hormone, a stress hormone, then we get these physiological and behavioral changes that can even be passed down to our children, even if we're not pregnant. They did a study with young boys between the ages of like 10 and 12. This was in a different European country many, many years ago, because one of the things they tracked was boys who started smoking around the age of 10 or 11, and started eating really, really bad foods. Like, these are boys, not girls, and they were like preteens. And these behavioral changes that happened in these preteen boys literally were passed down to the children they had years and years later. What? It's because of those epigenetic markers. So the things that you do, the kind of stress you undergo can literally change your body physiology, right? So that, to me, was kind of an important fact, because basically, if we go to the next slide, busy is bad. That's the idea. If we're busy, it's bad for us. And we know this. We know this. But like my Saturn, bless her heart, like my Saturn, we ignore the warning signs and we just drive it until it completely shuts off. So what do we do? Brené Brown has a great idea. Our friend Brené Brown says, crazy busy. Everybody said that? Oh, I'm crazy busy. Crazy busy is a great armor. It's a great way for numbing. What a lot of us do is that we stay so busy and so out in front of our life that the truth of how we're feeling and what we really need can't catch up with us. Did you catch it? Sometimes we stay busy because we're afraid to be still. Because when we're still, we feel things we might not want to feel. When we're still, we have to deal with our baggage. When we're still and silent, we have to deal with our trauma. So it's a trauma response. It's a response that says, I don't want to deal with any of that stuff, so I just got to stay on the path, stay busy. And we stay so out in front that we don't even know the truth of what we're feeling and what we really need. And I think that's one of the reasons maybe some of us stay busy all the time. There are other reasons. Maybe we stay busy because it looks good to other people. I think that's sort of a common myth that may be true for some, may not be true for others, but maybe it makes us look good. Maybe there's sort of a social cultural expectation that you're busy. If you say, you know, I didn't do anything all day long, people look at you funny. They're like, what? I had this to do and this and this and this. You must not be very good. You must not work very hard. You must not be very successful. That's sort of the, you know, right? You know that feeling. So there are all kinds of reasons why we stay busy, but busyness is causing stress, and the stress is killing us. It's really important to understand. I think that busyness is not the problem. I'm not here to talk to you about how to cure your busyness. Let me say that again. Busyness is not the problem. I think busyness is the symptom. I think it's the symptom. If we can get to the root cause of why we're always busy, then maybe we can sort of figure this out. So thinking about all this stuff, I'm reading about science, and I'm reading about the brain, and I'm reading about DNA, and then I have to think to myself, how does God fit into this, and how does Jesus fit into all this? And I was only halfway kidding, really wasn't kidding at all when I said Jesus made it all, right? God made it all. So it's that important. But here's the thing. We came to sort of a philosophical question in our Tuesday meeting. Actually, Sabrina joined Keith and I for our Tuesday meeting. She actually Skyped in. It was super cool, and we were sitting at Dunkin' Donuts having our little meeting, and she's there on FaceTime. It was great. But she brought up the point, we were kind of talking about, well, did people 2,000 years ago have the same kind of stresses that we have. And I was kind of thinking, well, you know, I think it's sort of humans are always humans, right? And people are always people, and the human condition, God speaks to the human condition, the gospel speaks to the human condition, so it should be sort of universal. But Sabrina was really smart, and she said, you know, I'm not so sure that that's true. Maybe God anticipated that or knew that this would be our situation, but I don't think there's a comparison to what people back then experienced and what we experience now. And over time, things change, and so we're experiencing new things. There's no doubt that we have new challenges in our life in 2019. Is that what year it is, 2019? Than they did 2,000 years ago, right? So I began to think about this, and my wife brought up this point to me, which is great. She brought up the idea of the fight or flight response. And so I was reading a little bit more about the fight or flight response, and, you know, it's kind of true. If you were living in Jesus' day, and you were walking along a dark path at night, you were probably scared of bandits, right? And you probably had this fight or flight response. And then a bandit jumps out and is ready to beat you up and take your money. You had two choices. You fought or you fled, right? Fight or flight. Today, you have an impending work deadline that's causing you a ton of stress. You get the fight or flight response. There's no one to fight unless you want to go fight your boss. And there's really nowhere to fly. So we don't get to fight or fly. Our body is saying fight or flight, fight or flight. And we're going, stay the course and just bathe in the cortisol. That's what's happening to us, literally. So we're not engaging with the fight or flight response, okay? So again, over time, our lives have changed, humanity has changed. But here's my core belief. Here's what I think, and I believe this to be true more than anything. I think God created it all. I think God knew who we were and what we were going to face when he intervened in the world at the very beginning of the story. And I think God knew who we were and what we were facing when he intervened in the middle of the story and when Jesus conquered all this stuff. I think God is the author of life. And so I think there's an answer in the gospel for this. And I also think that Jesus is the prototypical human. I think that Jesus exemplifies the best way to live as a human being on earth, whether that's 2,000 years ago, or now, or 2,000 years from now. I think Jesus tells us this is how you live as humans. And Jesus and the gospel and the Old Testament even have a way to tell us how to get things in order, how to work things out. So let's talk about our first verse that I want to share with you. This is just the question I just asked. I can't remember what my slides are, so Tyler's doing great. All right, here we go. Yeah, this is it. Haggai. So the familiar book of Haggai, which I'm sure you all read all the time. This is great. Really, the only reason this is up here is because Keith and I thought, what chance do we have to actually put a verse from Haggai up on the screen? I think that's pretty cool. Haggai is an Old Testament prophet. It's important to know it comes at the very end of the Old Testament. So things are kind of crazy at that point. This is during the time when the temple had been destroyed and God was telling his people to rebuild the temple. And Haggai was a prophet trying to tell his people, God is telling you that you're doing things wrong. That's what the prophets did. They had a terrible job. Nobody liked them ever because they had to say things that God was saying to the people and it was never good news. So here's what happens. Haggai is talking to the people. God is speaking through Haggai. So God says, you have planted much to the people of Israel. You have planted much, but harvested little. You ever felt like you've planted a lot, but your harvest isn't very big? Yeah. You've planted much, but harvested little. You eat, but you never have enough. You drink, but never have your fill. You put on clothes, but are not warm. You earn wages, only to put them in a purse with holes in it. Have you ever thought that about your money? Like, is there a hole in my bank account? What is happening? Right? When we are working so hard, stressed out, and busy, this is our life. We eat, but we're not full. We put on clothes, we're not warm. We earn wages, but our purse has holes in it. So God says this, give careful thought to your ways. Go up into the mountains and bring down timber and build my house. He's talking about the temple. Build my house so that I may take pleasure in it and be honored, says the Lord. Let's pause right there for a second. God is saying, build my temple. Let's remember that the temple was the way that God dwelled among his people. God was with the Israelites, but only in as much as they had the temple and God's presence was there. God is trying to say, you have a job to allow me to come be with you. You have to build this house where I can be. Okay? So that's what God is asking. Verse 9, he goes on, he says, you expected much, but see, it turned out to be little. What you brought home, I blew away. Why, declares the Lord Almighty? Because of my house, which remains in a ruin, while each of you is busy with your own house. And there's the catch. He's saying you're busy with your own house. You're busy tending to your own affairs, and you're not doing what is necessary to allow me to come and dwell with you, to be with you. Now, we don't have a temple anymore. Jesus actually said, in not so many words, that he was the temple. When he said, destroy this temple in 3 days, I'll raise it up again. And he did it because he was talking about himself and his body. Jesus is the temple for us, and he is the way that God dwells with us. And then Paul takes it one step further, and he says, you know what? No. You are the temple. He says it two times. He says the church is the temple of God. Think about that. You, the church, Life Path, you are where God dwells. But then he also says your body is a temple. So we get the clear picture in Scripture that the temple on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem is no longer the focal point, but God's presence with us still is. And God's message is the same. If you're tending to your own house more than you are worried about building a temple for God to dwell in your life, you're going to always be hungry. You're going to always be cold. You're never going to have enough money. This kind of sounds like punishment, right? He says, I blew it away. Or what you brought home, I blew away. It sounds like punishment. I don't believe it was. Even if the writers originally thought that it was, I believe this is the natural consequence of spinning your wheels and working so hard at trying to achieve and do and create and accumulate without paying attention to God dwelling with you. Does that make sense? So we need to make space for God to dwell with us. We need to build a temple in our lives, build a temple in our heart for God to come. Well, Jesus also said something about this. Let's go to the next one, Tyler. And this one, I'm sure you know this quote. This is a favorite. You should put this on a plaque. Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. And you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Notice what Jesus says here. He says, come to me and I will give you rest. He didn't say, well, you need to sort through your calendar and make sure you prioritize things and eliminate the things that you're not doing well and make time. He gave you one job. You have one job. Come to me. That's what he says. Come to me. That is your one job. I went to the dentist recently, so obviously it was on my mind as a sermon example because I've got to use something good about the dentist. It really did remind me, though, of this. Going to the dentist, like we don't walk into the dentist's office and sit down in the chair and say, okay, doc, hand me that drill, we got work to do, right? I mean, we don't help, right? We have one job, and that job is to show up. You just show up every 6 months when they send you the postcard or whatever. Some of us don't even do that. Maybe it's every 6 years and we drag ourselves in. Okay, finally, I got to go. But that's the job. When it comes to the dentist, you have to just go and you have to sit there. And the reason I think it's such a great example is because it's really uncomfortable. Like, it was just like, I went a few weeks ago and it was just an initial exam, just an initial visit, just x-rays. But oh my gosh, when they put like that gum lip spreader in your mouth to take those x-rays, I'm like, you're not even doing anything. And this is like really uncomfortable and painful. Stop it. Going to the dentist is uncomfortable. Just like showing up with Jesus is uncomfortable. We want it to be a wonderful, fulfilling time. Oh, I'm going to spend an hour with Jesus and it's going to be glorious and wonderful. Maybe not. Maybe you're going to spend an hour with Jesus and you're going to wrestle with dark emotions. Maybe you're going to struggle with some feelings that you didn't think you had. Maybe you're going to be made aware of some things that have got to be cleaned out. Spending time with Jesus can be like showing up at the dentist. You just have to do it. Your job is to show up, but it can be uncomfortable. So I think sometimes a lot of us think, well, I'd rather go to the dentist than spend an hour in silence with Jesus. Sometimes that would be preferable, right? We have to get there. We have to spend time with Jesus. So, in the book of Haggai, we see that we have to make a space, make a temple for God to dwell in us and dwell in our lives. And Jesus says, come to me and I will give you rest. He's going to do the hard work, but you have to come. And notice he says, take my yoke. He doesn't say, ditch your yoke. There are no yokes in Jesus' land. He says, take my yoke. It's still a burden, right? It's still a yoke. It's still a burden. It's easy, gentle, humble. He's humble, but it's easy and gentle. But he's saying still, you have to take my yoke. So show up with Jesus. Let's go to the next slide. Here are the things I think we can do. I think number one, we can focus on restoration, not relaxation. I think our knee-jerk reaction when it comes to busy schedules is, oh, I need to relax, right? And what we do to relax sometimes isn't very relaxing, right? Sometimes we want to sit down and binge watch every season of Game of Thrones. I'm relaxing. No, you're not. There's nothing relaxing about that, right? There's nothing relaxing about a lot of these activities we engage in. Another fascinating study that I read in preparation for this week was they surveyed a lot of people who, like, about their plans for the weekend. And people would say, oh, yes, I'm going to spend some time relaxing this weekend and rejuvenating this weekend or whatever. And then they had their time in the weekend. They had a lot of free time, but they spent it doing things like binge-watching TV and other things. And then they finished the weekend and they completed another survey and they said, I don't feel restored or rejuvenated at all. So it wasn't that they didn't have free time. It was how they used their free time that was important. So what is it that restores you? I'll give you a hint. It probably involves Jesus. Probably involves God. But it also could involve other things. Maybe going for a walk in the woods, in nature, helps you connect, reconnect, and it's restorative to you. Maybe sitting down with a pen, a really nice pen and really solid quality paper and writing poetry, maybe that really connects. Or maybe it's some sort of visual art. Maybe it's playing music. Whatever it is, something that connects you and restores you. And it's not just about relaxation. So I think that's one thing that we can do. Next one, we want to focus on being, not doing. We say this a lot around here. We focus on being, not doing. We're human beings, not human doings. Okay. We want to make sure that we are aware of the essence of who we are. The story that comes to mind here very frequently when we talk about being versus doing is the story of Mary and Martha. If you don't know the story, it's in Luke. Jesus shows up at the house of some good friends of his, and Mary and Martha are doing what you would normally do when a rabbi shows up, although they were doing it a little bit differently, right? So Mary was actually at the feet of Jesus, hanging on his every word, and sort of like listening to him and being with him. But Martha was like, we got to feed people. And she was in the kitchen banging around the pots and pans. And then she got grumpy and she said, Jesus, tell my sister to come in here and help me with the kitchen. And Jesus said, Martha, Martha, Martha. Mary's doing what's right. Being versus doing. Sometimes, and I want to say this very carefully, because you heard earlier this morning about all the great things we here at LifePath like to do for God's kingdom. That's important. The Sunday serve that we did, The fill the packs that we are currently doing, those are doing things for God's kingdom. Those are doing the work of the gospel, and that's really important. But I want you to understand it's no substitute for being in the presence of Jesus. We have to focus on being more than doing. And that's really, really important. And I'll tell you, here's a little hint. It's not a secret that for the next 3 weeks, we're going to be talking about similar themes like this. I think Keith is talking about Sabbath next week and then something else after that, because we're trying to lead you guys up and prepare you for the fact that we're about to have our first ever retreats, spiritual retreats, two in the fall, one for women, one for men at separate times. So those of you with kids can always make sure you have somebody at home with the little ones. This is a chance for you to focus on being. Unplug. Don't do anything. You just show up at this retreat, at a retreat center, and you can just be. And we'll provide you some guidance there. But it's really exciting that we're heading in that direction. And then finally, the third thing I think we can do is we can just come to Jesus. You have one job. Show up at the dentist. Show up to Jesus and say, Jesus, do with me what you will. Sit with him. Sit with him. And he can change. He can change your epigenetic code. And literally change the way your body functions. I promise you it's true. Like researchers who don't know Jesus are saying, hey, this is great. This whole meditation thing works and it changes all this. And Christians are saying, yeah, we've known that for a long time. Just pray. It's called prayer. It's called meditation. It's called being with Jesus. Right? So that's what I think we can do.